2008. Tonight we shall begin Masechet Sanhedrin, starting with the very first page, which is Amud Beis. All Gemaras begin with an Amud Beis. There's no Amud Aleph for the Gemara. Why? Well, the major reason, probably in my mind, is a very prosaic one. The first page is the title page, and so therefore they begin with the second page, okay? But a lot of people say it goes to show you that even though you think you know it, there's a lot that you don't know yet. And so that missing page shows you that there's a lot missing in your knowledge.
So we should go looking for the missing page, right. Is what you're saying.
So, okay.
You make your own page.
Right. All right. Okay, let me just say a couple of words of introduction to Sanhedrin. We have over here the tractate which deals with Jewish courts of law. And I don't have to tell you that courts of law are very, very important to a society. We are sort of thinking in terms of an ideal Jewish society which is based upon the Torah, and therefore one of the requisites is that it has to have a legal system, and there have to be courts of law. Even as we read in the Torah, Shoftim, Shotrim, Titeim L'chol B'chol Sherecha, right? You shall appoint judges or constables in all your gates. And then, of course, the admonition to the judges of Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof, which we'll come across later as we keep on learning over here, the idea of, you know, justice, justice shalt thou pursue, and what is the meaning of it, and so on. Okay? So, it's a little bit unusual in that in this particular tractate, in this particular chapter, the Mishnah of the entire chapter is presented right at the beginning. And then, as the pages go on, you know, there's a discussion on the various items that are presented in the Mishnah. The reason for that is that they wanted to give you a unified picture of what a Jewish court of law is. How many judges do there have to be? What is the nature of the cases or the crimes, you know, that they have to adjudicate, and so on and so forth. So we begin first of all with Dine Mamonos Bishloshot. Mamon, of course, means money, right? So in other words, laws, that is, let's say disputes that involve money, or cases that involve money, right? So you have to have a court of three judges, okay? Dine is literally the dinim of. The dinim of money, as I say, it means, you know, monetary cases, okay? And now they started to give some examples of what they mean by that. Gezelos v'chabolos b'shloshon. Example. Gezelos, Rashi explains that over here. Of course, we heard the word a goslin. What's a goslin?
A thief.
A thief, okay. So, is it a galif a thief?
Gezelos,
isn't Gezelos
in trouble?
Gonif,
yeah.
Or galif?
A galif. Oh, galif is also a thief, right?
Yeah. Is the word in Yiddish, do they think, use it to mean troubles?
Gazel, no. Gazel,
no. Gazelos.
It really means being robbed.
Means being robbed.
Right,
okay.
Yeah. It still has the Hebrew meaning involved.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So, a gazelos sometimes, you know, you got a tremendous bargain. So
oh,
you can say it's a steal. I can say it's a steal.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Right. All right. Greg? All right. Okay. So, gezelos. All right. Rashi gives two different explanations, actually, what gezelos means. I want to do quite a bit of Rashi at this particular point. Top line over there, okay? See the word gazelos? Okay, it says, first of all, the example that he gives is kofir b'fikodin, the mishaleich bo yod, heavy gazel. Okay. In ancient days, you had something and you entrusted it to somebody else, right? It's called a pikodin in that particular case. Literally, a deposit. You deposit something with somebody and ask them, please, watch over it for me, okay? By the way, what do we call that person who watches?
Shomer.
It's a shomer, right, okay, good. But in the Gemara, you have all kinds of shomer, right, okay. But this is a shomer.
We had the shomer too.
Yes, of course, all right. So anyway, this shomer, okay, he is koifer b'fikodo. In other words, he denies that he ever had the object, and instead, he uses it for his own purposes.
Okay.
Of course, you're not supposed to take a pikodon, you know, and it's given to you for safekeeping, safeguarding, safekeeping, whatever. Okay.
Right.
But, you know, you're not allowed to make any use, whatever, of it. What?
Okay.
That's already a different story. Then, in that particular case, is not anymore, as we would say, a shomer chinam. In other words, he's doing it for free, but it becomes then a shomer socher, somebody who is doing it for wages. And under those in that case, then there are different rules that apply to that.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't want to go into all the details at this particular point.
You
should have that bombitzia,
right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So that's one thing. But also, Rashi says, somebody grabs something that belongs to somebody else, and he takes it. So he's what? He's a gazlan. All right. So in this particular case, what happens? He's brought before the court of law, right? And how many do you have to have in order to judge this case? So the answer is, you need a court of three judges. Okay. The next one, chavolos. Chavolos is somebody hits you, causes personal injury to you. Okay? Now, in the Gemara again, not here, but, you know, in Bat Mitzia and so on, they speak about over there, about there are five different things that a person who is injured is entitled to. Doesn't mean that you're entitled to everything, but there are certain things, as for example, one of them would be shevis. Shevis means that you're not able to work. So you're entitled to what? To compensation for the time that you lost because you were unable to work. Or ripui, doctor's bills, hospital bills, and
okay.
So on. Right. Ripui, it's called. From the word refuah, it's the same idea.
Refuah.
Right.
For recovery.
Right. No, it means specifically paying doctor's bills, hospital bills, and so on and so forth. You know, somebody, I don't have to tell you that in American law, too, you know, some of these principles are applied also, right? There's also, for example, compensation for boshes. You're ashamed to show yourself in public because you've been disfigured or something like that. So you're entitled to that. Another one, huh? Boshes, it's called. Shame, right. You know the word busha?
Busha, no.
Busha means shame.
Means what?
Shame.
Shame? Oh, no.
It's a busha. It's a shameful thing. So. But boshes means that you're too bashful, you're too ashamed to show yourself in public or something like that. Or there's tsar, pain. So, you know, tsar, right. And there might be actual nezek as well. There may be actual damages besides that you have to compensate for. Or for example, I mean, if let's say your animal was killed in the accident or something like that, you know, whatever. So, again, who adjudicates this as to how much compensation and what manner of compensation and so on the person who has been injured is entitled to get? So the answer is, again, this has to be adjudicated before a bezdin of three judges. Nezek v'chatzin nezek. This deals with a different problem. we have in the Torah, Parsha Mishpatim, about an ox does damage, okay? So the question is, what is the penalty that has to be imposed upon the owner? So, first of all, if the ox is not known to have been vicious, okay, then, right, he's a tom, as we would say, then in that particular case, then the Torah says that he has to pay chatzi nezek. He has to pay half the amount of the damage that he caused, okay?
You mean if he gores somebody?
Right.
What if he killed him?
Then in that particular case, this already is a greater penalty, right.
Isn't there a 4 and 5 penalty?
We'll come to that.
Okay.
But right now, it's the difference between a tam and a muad. Once he's done it more than twice, it's already a chazaka. We know that this is a very vicious animal. In that case, he has to be judged differently.
Okay.
So, okay. And of course, I mean, if he kills a person or something like that, then I don't have to tell you. There's more involved, right?
Yeah, right.
So, who again can determine how much the damages should amount to? So that has to be brought before a court of three. Okay. Now the next one is Tashlume Kefal. Tashlume Kefal means that the ordinary gadav who is caught. So in that particular case, he has to give back twice the amount of what he sold, okay, to the owner. So in that particular case, again, it's up to the court in order to enforce it and to see that this is carried out, okay?
What does that mean?
What? Kefal? Kefal means twice the amount.
Huh?
Means kefal. Kefal is twice the amount. Tashlum be kefal. It's a double penalty.
Yeah, I know. Under what conditions? I mean,
he's a ganav. He's a ganav, and he's caught.
He's been caught. He has previous convictions. Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily. Could be the first time also.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So how does he? Okay.
He's not a mox.
Okay.
Muad le'olam.
He's
always. He has to pay twice the amount that he stole it.
Okay.
As compensation to the person for whom he stole it, right? Of course, there's another mice. I mean, if he confesses it, then there are other penalties, as you understand. I mean, I'm not going into every detail, but if he's caught red-handed and he has not confessed to the crime, then in that case, it's the penalty for him, okay?
Are witnesses required and things like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, witnesses are always required. That's another thing that the Gemara is going to go into, not over here, but there's a whole chapter devoted to witnesses, okay? Well, that's the next thing. That's the next thing. Tashlumi arbo v'chamisho, where you pay 4 or 5 times the amount. Okay, so the Torah says that if a man steals a sheep, then in that case he has to give back 4 sheep.
Why?
Four?
Why four?
Okay.
You just said two, twice.
This is a special.
I don't understand.
It's a special part. Look, the Torah says so. That's all.
Oh, this is just quoting the Torah? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
It says, Tamisha Bokar, 5 times the amount of an ox or cattle, right? The Arbatzon. And 4 sheep, Tachos Hashem, right?
That.
So, the Gemara has a very nice touch about why.
Yeah, one is easy to get and the other is not.
Right, it says that the sheep doesn't weigh as heavy, a sheep, a lamb, or something like that, so it's very easy to take it. Whereas an ox, that's already is more valuable because, you know, it's heavier than those. Right, right.
Yeah, has
right,
it also got something to do with the male or female?
No.
Because the male can.
No. In this case, it doesn't make any difference.
But the person has more audacity to take the bigger.
But it just only refers to livestock.
Yes.
Okay.
But for any other thing, except for the sheep, and the capital, right? Than the other rule of the Tashlumei Kefil. In other words, twofold compensation applies. This is an exception. And because it's an exception, so again, it's, you have to have a Besdin of three in order to judge this. Okay? Okay. All right. Now, the next one is Oines. Now, Oines is somebody who he forces... he rapes a woman. Okay?
Man.
Right. Now, of course, it all depends, you know, under what circumstances. We're talking about an unmarried woman, you understand? Because if he would rape a married woman, then already that's already a more severe penalty that's imposed upon him. He's liable to the death penalty in that case. Okay. Yes.
Doesn't it also apply to the place if it's further from the city, otherwise
the person. Yes. I mean, the Torah specifies the fact that if she's in the town, she can scream,
and so on.
But if she's away, there's nobody there to hear her. Right, exactly, yes. All right, but that's not got into over here at this point.
No.
Okay. Just to tell you that if a person is accused of raping, so you have to have a court of three in order to judge that particular case. Habifata, this is somebody who seduces.
A seducer.
Seduces a girl. Okay?
Talks her into it.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, there's a penalty again that the Torah assesses that he has to marry her. He has to give the father a hundred times the amount of kesef and so on and so forth. I mean, they're different things. Okay? So, this, again, has to be enforced, you know, before a court of three. Okay.
There are no juries.
No.
There
was no jury, just judges. Exactly. You're right.
No jury appears. No.
I do remember something that if he doesn't like her, but still the firstborn is the heir.
No.
Firstborn of the heir, this is a different story. This applies to a woman who is widowed.
Yeah.
I'll come to that in a moment. Okay. I'll come to
that. The one who marries the brother.
That's correct.
To have the name.
Right, yeah. Right. That's where it applies. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, the next one is Amotzi Shemra. Man accuses his wife of not having been a virgin when he married her.
Like Soto.
No.
Soto's a different case. In Soto, the man is married to this woman, okay? And then he warns her, I don't want you to have anything to do with so-and-so because he suspects that they're carrying on an affair. So even his jealousy, he can, you know, come to the court with witnesses and so on and so forth, and as a result,
just out of
spite.
Spite.
It's up to the judges to determine. The judges have to determine what the
case. But then he's a defamer, right? I mean, if the woman is found.
The Motzi Shemra, as I said, you're right. The Motzi Shemra could be generalized. You know that anybody who slanders somebody. I mean, this is the way that we use it
in
general.
Oh, talking about slander. Yeah.
Slander.
Okay,
but specifically what the Torah speaks about is a man who he marries and then he comes to the court the next day and says, look what I married. She was supposed to be a virgin and she's no virgin.
How does he prove that?
The parents have to show that she was a virgin. necessary with a bed sheet and so on. But according to the Gemara in that particular area over there, that says primarily that it has to be as clear to the judges that this really happened or not. Okay? Because they have to be able to discount the guy. The question is, for example, why would a person do that? Now, if it were really genuine on his part, the reason would be because he spent so much money on the chatzanah and setting up a home and everything else because he expected her to be a virgin, you understand? She claimed she was. He expected that she was. And therefore, he was given a raw deal.
Right. In today's society, it's not the...
I'm not talking about today's society. I'm talking about society in those days.
Yeah,
okay.
The person paid for the whole wedding?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Paid for the wedding. He paid to set up a home. You see, they had a system that... The first step that they had was called Erusin or Kiddushin,
right.
Whatever you want to call it. It means that, you know, he says to her, sure, you are Mekadeshously or Melresously, the different expressions that you could use. But the point is that at that moment, she belongs to him. And she is his wife.
He belongs to her.
Yeah, she is his wife, okay? Now, they don't immediately begin living together. That's a different story.
Right.
Instead, they had a system whereby either they waited 6 months or they waited a whole year in order to enable the chassid to be able to find a job, to be able to have a home, furnish a home, etc., etc. Okay. And then, you know, they... Then they had nisuin, where, you know, they would then, you know, have a separate ceremony, whereby from this point on, you know, she lives together with him. You understand? So this was the idea. So the question is, if the guy spends all this money, naturally he wants to make sure that he's not throwing away his money. He spent it with the idea that she is a virgin. And so therefore, if he finds that she's not a virgin, he comes and he complains to the Besdin. Of course, the Besdin has to examine and find out whether this is really the case or it's not the case.
The rabbis have to look into the thing, right?
Yes, okay.
Now, still, is that like in today's society, we call it fraud, for which he can have an annulment of the...
Yes, yes. It's called the Mekach Toros, which means a mistaken deal, okay. It is fraud, okay.
For which you can get an annulment.
Correct. Right. Today's world, I don't guarantee it works because we don't have the Sanhedrin today. Even though we have Besdins, but the Besdins today, right? The Besdins in our society, I mean, even Jewish Besdins don't have the authority that the Sanhedrin had back in the old days, or that a Besdin operating in Eretz Israel, let's say, had in those days. And even in Babylonia they had Besdins, but they did not have in every respect the same authority as in Eretz Israel, because Eretz Israel was Eretz Israel.
Well, they even had the Besdins later on. My great grandfather was the chief judge in Suho.
Right.
State.
Correct. We have Besdins everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean,
now they have set up Besdins all over the country, right?
Yes.
Special Besdins that
are
appointed by the...
Have an ad hoc Besdin. That's, for example, if you need a Besdin for conversion or something like that. Right. But it does not have the same legal authority that the Besdin had in the days when the Gemara Sanhedrin was, because that was in a Jewish state, if you wish, okay? And they had power to enforce their judgments. Today, the average Jewish Besdin, it has the power if the people who are litigants are willing to abide by it. But what if they're a bunch of fakers and they say, I'm not satisfied, I'm going to the civil court? Who can stop them? You understand? So it's a different story. Right.
They don't talk about capital crime here. They don't talk about...
We'll have it.
Later on, yeah.
Of course, absolutely.
Okay.
We're describing a system, you know, that takes in everything.
Okay.
Not just civil law, but also criminal law.
I don't want to want to
well,
jump the gun.
Yeah, right, okay. We've only just begun. Only just dipped into it, okay.
Well, it takes 3 years to become a lawyer in law school.
Right. Now,
Omrim.
All right, so anyway, we're up to Amosi Shemar, right? We said Mishlosha 3, right? Divrei Rabbi Meir, right? This is Rabbi Meir's opinion. But Chachamim Omrim, but the sages say, no, 3 is not enough. Motzi Shemar be Esra Mishlosha, Bipnei Sheyesh Bodin in the Foshes. Says, no. Motzi Shemar has to be tried by a court of 23 judges, because there's a possibility that it might result in the death penalty.
Death penalty?
Right.
For defaming?
No, not for defaming. But if it can be proved that she really had an affair with another man during the time before they lived together. Remember I said there's a space between the time that they had Erison and the time that they finally had Nisuyin. Okay? Now, she was his wife from the moment that they had Erison. But what if she had an affair between that time and the time that, you know, the husband finally took her, and they started to live together? That's why he's yelling and so on.
Yeah,
so,
but is he called the defamer here?
Yeah. I guess so. I mean, I didn't look at the English translation.
No, I'm saying...
If you would decide... Different reasons between
Nisuin. Yeah, he has to give her a get.
He has to give her a get,
and he has to pay her huksuba. Exactly.
Even though they.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're describing adultery, actually.
Yes, she committed adultery, right.
Right, so that would be a death sentence for.
Yeah, it could be for both, right? For the adulterer and for both, man and the woman, right. But again, it has to go before a court. But they're saying, since there is a possibility that it might result in a death penalty, that's why it has to be judged by a court of 23.
I would hope that they explain why 23, why not 20, why not 25.
Well, we'll come to that. Abyssal Gadol. We'll get there. It's a great big Mishnah, as you can see.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know whether we'll cover the entire Mishnah tonight or not. We'll try. Okay.
Are you still in Rashi?
No, I'm explaining the text of the Mishnah itself.
Oh, so where are we on the Mishnah? I've been listening.
Neshesh Bodin Nefoshes. Okay, that would be three.
Mishnah continues.
Yeah, it's on the sixth line.
Right.
Now, the next type of a case would be Makos. Because we studied Makos a long time ago, if you remember. And Makos by itself means... Yeah, it is.
39 lashes.
39 lashes, okay. Unless a person can't stand it, in which
don't,
case...
Don't ask why not 40, but 39.
Well, because they don't want to shame one, right?
What did you just say? 39
My tradition is 39 lashes, not 40.
Why?
Even though they talk about Arboim, right? The Torah says Arboim, Yakedo. Right?
Why 39? Because they shouldn't exceed it.
Right. Not to exceed, but also there's another reason. There should be Vindiklo, Ochicha Biedecha. We don't want to shame this person either. And giving him that extra marker would be an additional disgrace. He had his penalty. Okay, that's it.
But that's specified in the Torah, right?
Yeah.
So that's the whole point.
Right. Now, for what is markers? I mean, they give markers for various reasons, but essentially what it amounts to is for a violation of a law of the Torah. In other words, a negative commandment in the Torah.
Thou shalt not.
Right, thou shalt not. Okay. Right. Pardon me?
Marcus Margus
is one type of Margus, where the court has the authority to impose this particular punishment upon someone even if it's not a violation of the law, but for some other, you know, transgression, which brings disgrace to the community, in order to enforce a little discipline, something like that. So then there is a possibility, but that's only one type. The average one is because a person violated the law of the Torah, and so he gets malchus for it. Okay.
Talking about malchus,
what do they call it?
Lashes.
Yes.
Does that relate in any way to a parent and a child?
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Of course, we're talking about lashes given by the best. By the best. We're not talking about a parent takes a strap to a kid.
This kind of punishment,
right.
In general use, it was history, you know,
Yeah, of course.
Ships they gave the lashes.
Right, absolutely.
And parents were supposed to, spare the rod, spoil the time.
Right, exactly.
I wonder if that came from these rules originally.
Well, obviously there's a relationship over there, right? But we know that people will hit somebody, use a strap to somebody, in order to try to enforce discipline or something like that. But we're talking really about cases that have to be brought before a Beis Din. How many judges? Right. So, according to this opinion, such a case involves three judges. But Mishum Rabbi Yishmael Amru B'Esher Mishlosha. Rabbi Yishmael is with the opinion that three judges are not enough, you need 23. Ivar HaChodesh.
What he's saying is that any case that requires lashes has to have 23 judges.
According to Rabbi Yishmael, but the Chacham say three. And that's the deal, the three.
Right?
The Chacham. The followers of Chacham. Court of three.
Okay.
The next category is Ibur HaChodesh. Ibur HaChodesh means that the Beis Din has to make a determination as to whether to add an additional day to the month. Okay? So that instead of a month of 29 days, then you have to make it 30 days. This is the reason, incidentally, why we have 2 days Rosh Chodesh. Because some months have only 29 days and others have 30. Well, we have a fixed calendar, so it's El Chokhmah that's involved in it, except if you look at the Luach, right? But in those days, everything was done by sight. That's what we learned in Gemara Rosh Hashanah, if you remember. Right. So, again, how many judges?
Three.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ibar HaShodah. Likewise, to declare that this should be a leap year also requires a Beis Din of three. Okay, Mishlosha. Right. Mishlosha. Divrei Rabbi Meir. This is Rabbi Meir's opinion.
But that's
right?
Now pre-calculated now, right?
Yes. So? Yes. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Loi Meir, he says, Mishlosha Maschilim, we begin with three. But we had another two judges in order to continue the discussion. Your name, and so on. The Gomrin Bishiva, and they wind up with seven judges. However, even he says, however, if they had only three judges who made the determination, then it is. The year is.
Otherwise, there was only three judges left. Make the decision.
Either that or to begin with, even though he says that there should be three judges, five judges, seven judges, but nevertheless, even he agrees that if only three were there, but they have the authority to declare it, right?
Yeah, no court of appeals.
No. But as we learned in the Gemara Rosh Hashanah, they had to be people from the Sanhedrin Gedolah who made this. Even though there were only three, but it wasn't, from an ordinary court of law. It had to be from the Sanhedrin Gedolah in Yerushalayim that determined. but three of its members were enough in order, you know, to take testimony and decide that, okay, time to have a leap year. We learned over there, it's going to be also mentioned over here, some of the reasons for making an Ibiyur. Of course, essentially, it's because if we didn't have an Ibiyur, then the season would get out of whack, like it does with the Mohammedan calendar.
Pesach wouldn't be Pesach in the spring.
Exactly, right. And the Torah says that Pesach has to be, you know, Bechodesh Ha'aviv, in the month of Aviv. So it has to be at that time. Just as Sukkot has to be Bitkufas HaShol, at the time when you have, again, you know, the change in the seasons of the year taking place. In other words, the beginning of the fall, approximately.
Is there a Gemara that explains how this how that's done? How we finally figured out?
The closest that you have is the Gemara Rosh Hashanah that we studied. But
they figured out the extra day and the extra month and when it was...
They did it by observation. Obviously, historically, it happened that around the year 400 or something like that, the Christians had become the big shots in the Roman Empire, had become Christianized, and they were anti-Semitic. And they made life miserable for Jews. So eventually, the man who was the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael at that time, you know, the head of the Jewish community, his name was Hillel. He happened to be the fourth man to bear that name, Hillel. Okay, so you know, he was a descendant, of course, originally the original Hillel. So he decided the time had come to set aside, figure out a calendar that you know would be that they'd be able to figure out in advance, which was a month of 30 days, which was a month of 29 days, when you had to have an Ibiyur and so on. And, you know, we work on a calendar of a cycle of 19 years.
So Hillel did it.
Yes.
Instead of going out and looking
to
see when the month
right, because we don't have a Sanhedrin anymore who can determine
that. That's exactly what it is. Who knows, you know.
Well, it's a really different story. In Eretz Yisrael, it's more likely that you'll have a nice bright sky or something like that at night over there. Yeah. I still remember one Tisha B'av that I was there. Well, they finished, you know. The custom is not to say Kiddush Levana until after Tisha B'av went out. That moon was so bright and shiny over there in the sky. Made an impression on me that I won't forget.
Alright.
Okay. Now, the next thing is Smicha Sakedim. Okay? Smicha Sakedim. We think, you know, when we hear about smicha, you know, we think in terms of the rabbinical and so on and so forth. Right. And that's going to be mentioned also. But there's another interpretation as well given to it. We have, since we're talking about sacrifices and so on and so forth, one of the types of sacrifices that we have is called a chatos, a sin offering. Sin offering is specifically if you did something wrong, but you did it not realizing that you did it, did something wrong. Right. So, once you realize it, then you have to bring a chatos. But this is something that applies not just to an individual. No, it's all right.
Huh?
I think I'm running. I'm running through my speed.
To the water.
Right. Continue. Okay. What happens if the entire congregation does the wrong thing, based, of course, upon the fact that the Bezin itself gave the... That's okay, thank you. The Bezin itself gave the wrong interpretation of the law. You understand?
They were misled.
Right, they were misled. Misled because the Bezin itself gave the wrong interpretation of the law. There are others that are also mentioned. I mean, if it is the Nasi, for example, the head of the tribe who sins, if a whole tribe sins and stuff like that and so on. But this is what we call the Par Helim Dover. It's an ox that has to be brought as a chatos on behalf of the entire community if such a thing happened. And then it's written in the Torah, Somchu Zikneho Edo Esideh Malrosh Hapor. Okay? In other words, the elders of the community have to place their hands upon the head of the animal that's going to be used as a sacrifice for the chatas. So the word that means, you know, to put your hands down on it, well, so that word is that's smichah, you see.
Yeah.
So obviously the entire community can't all gather together and put it on the ox.
Right.
How many do you need? So the answer is you need three judges in order to do that. Three zikne hoedah. Earth, thank you very much.
Where are we on page?
In the middle of the page.
Which long line?
I'll tell you in a moment. Okay, I just want to identify the fact that tonight is the 2nd of April, in the year 2008. And we shall continue right now with the Mishnah at the beginning of the first chapter of Sanhedrin. The first part we dealt with courts, various types that had to decide in cases, well, to begin with, monetary cases, and then after that, that developed into some other types, as for example, gzela, somebody stole, or those cases in the Torah where we have special penalties involved, such as double penalty, the penalty of 4 and 5, or in the case of the ones and the fata, in other words, the rapist or the seducer, that he has to give also a monetary compensation. So that these were some of the things that we saw required a bezin of three. Okay? And then, so the last thing that we recorded before I had my coughing spell was smichas sakenim varifas eglo. That would be the first line, the first long line. So I'll review from that point because we didn't get on the tape last time. Okay? All right. The smicha skedim, as I told you, this had nothing to do with smicha of rabbis. Okay? But what we're talking about was the parhel of David, in which, as I said, you heard a few moments ago, that if the Bezdin caused the entire people to err, then in that particular case they atoned for it by bringing this par, and it's written over there that the Somchu Zikne Hoedos Yudehem, that the elders of the congregation have to put their hands on it, you know, in order to show that this is on behalf of the entire people that this sacrifice is being offered in order to atone for the sin. So, again, how many is the Canaan? You can't have the whole army, you know. You can't have a whole people doing it. So the answer is three. Back again to number three. All right.
So far, haven't they all been three?
Yes. You'll soon see, however, that there are others that require more. All right. Now, the next thing that they mention is Arifas Eglo. In other words, this is where we learned that if a murder has been committed, we don't know who committed it, right? So in that particular case, they have to measure to see which city is the closest to it, and then the Zkenim of that city have to go out, and they have to, again, you know, kill this animal, this heifer over there, and say, your data lo shofres adom mazev, you know, right. Exactly, right. We did not spill this blood, right, and we didn't see what happened over there, right? And then they continue with Kapir Le'amcha Yisrael, forgive thy people Israel, and, you know, may there be no more shedding of innocent blood in the land, okay? So, again, how many Sekenim are involved in that? Of course, the answer is 3. Okay. Now, the next thing that they mentioned over there, right. The next thing that was mentioned over there was Mishnah Shivan, Rabbi Yehuda, or Chamisha. Rabbi Yehuda has his reasons based upon how he interprets the word over there, the word Ziknei, to say that you have to have 5 Zikadim and not just 3. However, in reality, probably 3 would be enough. That they mention Hachalitza. So we know that if a woman is married, she never had a child, the husband died, then in that case there's a mitzvah in the Torah for her brother-in-law to marry her. What if the brother-in-law doesn't want to marry her?
That's true.
Right, and in that particular case, then you have to go before a bezdin of 3. And she has to remove the shoe over there, she has to spit in his face, and so on and so forth. And, you know, that frees her that she can marry anybody else from that point on. Except the Kohen, I have to tell you. When it comes to the Kohanim, they're more strict about that. Okay. All right. The next one that they mention over there, Miyunin. Miyunin is a minor girl, a young girl, below the age of puberty, who gets married, because the father has the right to marry her off, but she doesn't like the husband. So in that case, as she's about to reach maturity, then in that particular case, she has the right to say, I don't want this marriage. That's all. But it has to be confirmed by whom? It has to be confirmed by a court of 3. That's the point. That's what they mean by miyunin. Okay? That's Mishlosha, also by 3. Right. Okay. The next one is Neta Revai, Masi Sheni, Shein Dovo Yudun. Mishlosha. Okay. Neta Revai, this refers to the fruit of trees, where we know that for the first 3 years of that tree, the fruit cannot be used, period. We call them Arelim. Uncircumcised, okay, that's the word that the Torah uses, okay? And then, or the technical term that we use in order to describe this, called Orla. If you take a look on products that come from Eretz Yisrael that are 100% kosher, they'll tell you that they're free from all kinds of things. Trumas, masras have been given, and they're free from Orla, okay? In other words, it's not the fruit, it's not the first 3 years. In the 4th year, that's what Neta Revai means, then in that particular case, the fruit is permissible, but it has to be brought to Yerushalayim, to the Beis HaMikdash, and enjoyed in Yerushalayim, okay? Enjoyed in Yerushalayim. However, what if the journey is long, and the fruits are going to spoil? Then in that particular case, all right, and that, and of course, Marsa Sheni is a somewhat similar law. Marsa Sheni means the second tithe, which means that the, you know, every year there's a first tithe, and then in the first, second, and fourth and fifth years of the 6-year tithing cycle, then you have a Marsa Sheni. that also. The food has to be brought to you, Yerushalayim, alive and enjoyed there. But again, what happens if you can't? You know it's going to spoil or something like that. So in that case, you bring it and you don't know what is the actual value of it. So you bring it to the Beis Din and they decide what the value is, and the money that you get from the sale of the product over there is the money that you take to Yerushalayim in order to buy food in Yerushalayim itself. Of course, that was in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. But we still, you know, preserve the idea that oral is certainly prohibited. Okay? Now, the next thing that they mention over there is ha-hekdeshes. Okay. Hekdesh is anything that you offer up to the Beis HaMikdash. It's an offering. Okay? I don't mean it's a sacrifice. Well, I mean it's an offering, whatever it may be. Hekdesh can apply to various things. For example, I could offer up an animal as hekdesh, but that animal is not there for slaughter, you understand? That animal is what? So the temple treasury either can make use of it, or else they could sell it, okay? And the same is true, you know, with some other things. As for example, the Torah mentions land. You can dedicate your land, you know, to the Beis HaMikdash, the hekdesh, okay? So, you want to buy it back? Yes. Of course, if you don't want to buy it back, somebody else is going to buy it. You understand? So you got first crack at buying it back. But its value has to be determined as to how much it's worth. And naturally, who determines it? So the answer is a court of three. Naturally, there were bezdins also in the Beis HaMikdash itself, the Beis Din Shel Kahanim, mentioned several times, okay? But the Beis Din, and he says also, that's Mishlosho, right? And Rabbi Yehuda adds, he says, Echad Mehen Kohen, at least one of the Beis Din has to be a Kohen. After all, Hekdesh is, you know, it's Beis HaMikdash property, so if you want to buy it from the Beis HaMikdash in that particular case, there should also be a kind involved in this court as well. Yes.
What kind of?
Pardon me.
What kind of items is erech? Erech. What kind of?
Erech is something else. Or coming. That's also. All right. Now, what are they? Okay. Right. So anyway, that's you know, three, and then. Okay. This means that there is some object that you want to dedicate to the Beis HaMikdash. For example, I mean, you have a precious goblet, let's say, something like that. You want to dedicate it to the Beis HaMikdash, okay? So, because metaltalin means that literally it's movable. In other words, it's something that you can carry from one place to another. Okay, so let's say you want to give a goblet. You have a beautiful silver goblet or a gold goblet that you want to give to the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, then you decided you want to buy it back. Or as I said, if you don't want it, maybe somebody else wants it. Okay, so in that particular case, that also has to be determined as to its value by a court of three. And obviously, since we're talking about the Beis HaMikdash again, the same idea that one of them has to be a Kohen. Okay? Arochin usually refers not to this kind of an erech, because normally Arochin refers to what the Torah says, that a person can say, I am offering erkioli. I mean, it's the phrase, the phraseology that we have. And in that particular case, the Torah specifies if it's an adult male, how much, how many shekels it has to be. If it's a female, how many shekels it has to be. If it's a child, if it's an older person, and so on. And said, there are different things. You take a look at the last chapter of Vayikra, and you find the listing over there. And that's also where we find about the business about soil also. Karka can also be dedicated to Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So that's the next thing that they're going to mention. So, again, in order to determine the value, if you want to purchase it back, then in that particular case, that has to be also judged by a court of three, including a Kohen, since the Beis HaMikdash is involved. Okay, in other words, we follow Rabbi Yehuda in this case. And then, for Harkar Kors, that's land, right? Now, here, because land requires a greater amount of knowledge as to what real estate is worth and so on, so therefore you have to have a court which consists of Tisha the Kohen. It has to be nine and at least one Kohen, right? Okay. So that being the case, they decide what is the value of the property if you want to buy it back. The Odom Kayotzi Behen, and if a person, you know, also feels that he wants to redeem himself from a hektish. In other words, this is not where he said erkiolai, but he says, I want to offer my services as if I were a slave. Okay? You understand? As if I were a slave to Beis HaMikdash. So in that particular case, you need a court in order to determine what would he be worth if he were a slave. How much would he sell for? Do you understand? And that, of course, is given as a donation to the Beis HaMikdash. And again, why does it say Kayetzi Bahen, like it, likewise? Likewise means that also you have to have nine and one Kohen, at least, okay, in order to determine that. All right. So far we've been dealing, with all kinds of things, but there's no question that three is the normal thing. However, now we come to some where we have others. Okay. So the next thing that we say, all right, this is the new material. Dinei nefoshes be esra mishlosha. When it comes to capital cases, in other words, where it's possible that there is a death sentence involved, then in that particular case, there you have to have a court of 23. Okay? We'll come back later, a little bit later down on the page over there, how they got the number 23. Okay? So, now they give an example of other possibilities where maybe there is a death penalty that would be involved. Of course, I don't have to tell you the death penalty is not automatic, because under Jewish law, this we learned when we studied Makkos, that you have to give warning the person, you have to say to this person, you know, if you commit this crime, this will be your penalty, and it has to be, and there have to be witnesses, you know, who warn him and so on. And if he says, I don't give a damn, whatever you say, I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway, and so on. So that kind of a person deserves a death penalty. But if a person did something unwittingly, didn't know he was doing wrong, then in that particular case, you don't give them the death penalty. Instead, what do you give them?
Marcus
usually, right. It's an alternative, okay? It's an alternative. So now they have several different cases that fall into that category. Okay. Horoveya v'had nirba b'yesu mishlosha. Okay. The roveya is the person who commits, who has sexual intercourse with an animal. V'had nirba is the woman who has sexual intercourse with an animal. Okay? Unfortunately, we read about these cases occasionally. Right? Okay? It's perversion. Okay. But there are people who are guilty of that. So, at any rate, such a case has to be tried by a court of 23. Shenemar, because the pasuk says, V'harakta es ha'isha v'es ha'behema, that the woman who committed this kind of a crime and the animal both have to be put to death. the Omer, and there's another pasuk that says, "V'yes habehe batarogo." You have to kill the animal. All right. So now we see that not only a person is liable to be judged with the death penalty, which would require 23 judges, but even an animal, because the animal was a partner in this particular affair. Okay? Ruth, you're not happy about that.
The animal can't object.
The animal can't object? I don't know. I guess not. But the idea being, however, there's such a perversion that we don't even want to look upon it. We don't want to see this animal and say, you know what happened? You know this animal? Yeah. That's the reason why. Okay. Yes, I'm a Hebathar. Okay. So, however, we'll learn later that Rogel, they interpret a little differently. They say, okay, an animal you can put to death, but you don't put a human being to death. But that's already a little different. Okay. Yeah. However, here we're taking it literally in this sense. Okay. All right. Since we're talking about animals, the next animal that they discuss is the Shor HaNiskol. Who is the Shor HaNiskol? So this we know, an animal that gores. It's been warned once, and the owner has been warned, right? And still the animal gores again, and the owner again has been gored, and it happens a third time, so Yenug. At this particular point, the animal and the owner are brought before the court, and according to the Torah, again, the owner should be put to death as well as the animal. But in reality, as I say, they interpret this in the sense, you know, that the animal is going to be put to death. So this is what we call the Shor HaNiskol, because what is the penalty, the death penalty for the animal? The answer is skila. What is skila? Skila is stoning. Stoning. You throw a big stone and smash the head, you know. That's stoning, okay. After all, every Yom Kippur, you know, skila, sreifa, herik, mechedek, you know.
So, the idea that rather not with the shrita type of.
Right.
Killing, which is supposed to be kind.
Right. Shrita would be for an animal using it for eating purposes, but the Shor HaNiskol cannot be used. It has to be punished, okay? So, that being the case, you're not allowed to shecht it, but it has to be stoned to death, okay?
There's also stoning humans.
Yes, absolutely. As I say, I mean, when we, you know, in Yom Kippur, we talk about Al Chatoyim and so on and so forth, right? So Skilo, Sreifa, Herik, Mechedek, these are the four different types of execution, okay? Yeah, well, that's about what we're talking about. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Not goring an ox. Goring an ox, that's in the surface of death penalty.
Then that becomes property.
That's right. Yeah. That already goes
that's
into the choice. Other one about.
That becomes a choice.
Exactly, right. So that's already mominous, right. Which, again, has to be judged by a court of three.
Right.
But that's not something that deserves a death penalty. Talking about an animal that gores people to death. That's what we're talking about. Okay?
You may not have lived in Spain.
Yes.
In Sardin, where they did bullfighting.
Right.
The goring was going on all the time.
Yes.
Of course, it wasn't in the Jewish community.
No, exactly. Yeah. This was a goyish sport.
In a society.
Yeah.
Can imagine?
Absolutely.
Running of the bulls in Spain.
Yeah. The bullfighting.
Yeah.
They run them in the street.
Yeah, but the actual bullfighting.
Right. Look, we have a principle in Tzar Balei Chaim, which means that you have to have compassion upon animals and not cause them any pain. one of the principles that we have in Yiddishkeit. Okay.
Right. Well, that's why I
right.
asked about the Shita.
Right.
The
right.
Morning.
Correct. But as I say, here we're dealing with a theoretical situation.
Yeah.
But the idea was that look, if you own a vicious bull that you know is, you have to take very special care to make sure that the bull is not going to go around and kill people. So it's as simple
yeah,
as that. Right.
Yeah, pit bulls.
Right, pit bull,
yeah.
Exactly. It would be the same thing. And we'll see in a second that it's not only a bull,
but
there could be other animals as well. This is what we'll be coming to right now. Okay? But anyway, to finish first this one, where it says, you know, it's based upon the, you know, Shor HaNiskol B'Eshem B'Shlosho, right? You need a quarter 23 for the ox that is to be stoned to death. Because Shadam, I know the Pasuk says, HaShor Yisokel, right? That the ox is to be stoned. The gun be all of you must, and also its owner is to be put to death. And we say, Kibisas be all him, even as the owner has to be put to death with this penalty of skila, so kach misas asher. So likewise, the death of the ox, same thing. All right. But as I say, they get around afterwards with another interpretation that primarily were interested in the ox, not in the person, okay? Okay. Now, to continue. Hazaev, a wolf. Bahari, a lion. Hadov, bear. Hanomer, a leopard. Bahabardalis, a cheetah. No, some say that this is a leopard. The question is, which one was it? Bahadokosh, a snake. Right? Misasam b'yesam b'shlosha. If they kill a human being, then what? You get them before the court and sentence them to death. Okay, it's a nice theory, right? You gotta catch them first. But Rabbi Eliezer Omer, he says, Kol ha'koydem lahorgon zofa. Whoever kills them first, he has the merit. Having okay, but
would that infer that they would go hunting the animal actually?
No, they didn't go purposely hunting, but if they were threatened,
well, that's what I mean.
Yeah, if they're threatened by an animal, then don't wait to be eaten up by them, right? Don't wait to be killed by them, kill them first. That's all. Same thing you could say. I mean, if a person wants to kill you, kill him first. You know, this is also a principle that we have over here. It's not mentioned in the Mishnah here, but in the course of discussion, it's brought out too. Okay. But Rabbi Akiva, Omer, Misasa, Miesa, Mishlosha. Rabbi Akiva insists that they should have a trial before a court of 23. A little surprise to Rabbi Akiva, because he's a very, very bright guy. And it makes more sense that if you face something as dangerous as an animal that's going to kill you, right, either kill it or get far away from it. Take your pick. Okay. Now, so far we've had courts of 3, courts of 23. With a couple of exceptions mentioned previously, as for example, last week we had, among other things, Ibur Hashona. In other words, to determine whether it should be an Ibur Yor, right? Whether to have a leap year or not, that had to be determined by a court based in the Sanhedrin. But how many judges were involved? So there it said that you start with 3, then 2 more are added in order to continue the discussion and see what they have to say, and finally wind up with 7 judges. Okay. And partly it's based upon the fact that this is, you know, what they look for. They look for something in the Bible that gives a hint of this. And so what is the hint in the Torah? It's the priestly benediction. How many words do we have in the first bracha? Three. Yivarechecha Hashem Yishbarecha, right? How many in the second one? Yoer Hashem Pono Velecha Vichudecha. Five, right? And finally, Yisa Hashem Pono Velecha Vyosev Lecho Shalom. Right, okay. Right. So that's how they derive that.
We also had a five among here.
Yes.
Right,
right, right. That's correct. Okay, so now we go to the big Sanhedrin, the great Sanhedrin, okay? Things that require the great Sanhedrin. Ein donin lois hashevet, velois nevi hasheker, velois kohen godol, elo api bezdin shal shivim miyechot. When it comes to judge if the whole tribe has sinned, has committed avodah zarah, served the idolatry, okay? So in that particular case, who is going to judge whether the tribe deserves the death penalty for, you know, for worshipping avodah zarah? So you have to have a Sanhedrin which contains 71 judges, obviously, because in 71 you're going to have all kinds of opinions and so on. So if it is possible to find schus, you know, to find merit and so on in that particular case, more, much more likely to do that. Also, what they have in mind is the fact that things that are extremely important, as for example, a whole tribe is an important entity, it's not an individual, you understand, right? Or the next one, Nevi Hasheker, someone who is a false prophet. How do you know whether he's a false prophet or not, or something like that? So, you need the Sanhedrin Gedola in order to judge whether a person is a false prophet, and then in that case, if they convict him, then he's sentenced to death. Yes, Jerry.
Well, with the Sanhedrin of 71.
Right.
And if you're trying somebody, yeah, he could die of old age before with 71 of these people discussing and debating.
There's you're thinking of the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House of Representatives. Theory, a Jewish court had to make a decision within 2 days when it's a capital case. It's one of these things we'll learn later on, the Gemara.
You mean that, so the clock was running and they would...
Right, right.
It couldn't go on forever then.
No, because that already is considered halonas hadin, which means that you're dragging out justice. Mm-hmm. Justice has to be decided as soon as possible. Okay. But in order to make sure that they're not too hasty when it comes to a death penalty, so they determined that you have to have a night intervene. You have to have a night intervene. 2 days with an intervening night and before you come to a decision. So it'll give you a chance to think and find out, you know, if there are any witnesses who could come and find, you know.
So how many days?
You start during the day, okay? Mm-hmm. Then that night, you know, and then the following day. So in other words, as I said, there's an intervening night, mm-hmm, but they don't decide it on the same day. Monetary things can be decided the same day.
Mm-hmm.
But capital cases require 2 days.
2 days with
right,
intervening night.
Right, right.
How did they pick the extra one?
What do you mean by the extra one?
Well, the Sanhedrin is 70 elders, 71.
Well, we'll come to that. We'll come to that.
They wouldn't have a Kohen extra?
Maybe not.
Oh,
that's not specified over here. It's not specified. We'll come to it. A little patience. A little patience. Okay. We're coming to it. Yeah. All right. So they feel that a false prophet requires the great Sanhedrin to decide whether he was really a false prophet or what, or, you know, what the circumstances are. Likewise, the Kohen Gadol is a person of such prestige that you don't simply throw him into an ordinary court. You have to have the High Court of Justice, so to speak, okay, the Sanhedrin Gadol, in order to judge his case. So it says, a Dodin, you know, don't judge an LLP based on Shoshim Miechad. You have to have a court of 71 in order to judge them. Likewise, V'yein Motzin and Elchemes HaRishus LLP based on Shoshim Miechad. Okay. You want to make war. War comes in two different categories. Category one is called Milchemes Chovo, a war of obligation. And the opposite one is called Milchemes Rishus. Literally, it's a war that you decide that you have to go to war, but it's, you're not obligated to actually fight. You understand? No, you don't get it. Okay. Let me explain. All right. They define the Milchemes Chovo is one of two types. One is the war that was waged by the people of Israel in order to conquer Eretz Israel. Why? Because that was commanded in the Torah, that they had to fight the Canaanite people in order to get possession of Eretz Israel. Okay? So that's a Milchemes Chovo. The other type of a Milchemes Chovo, you're attacked. You have to defend your life. You have to defend your country. In that particular case, it's also a Milchemes Chovo. Okay? But what if you decide that you don't like this and you feel that you have to expand the boundaries or something like that? You have to make war. It's a threatening situation, and yet it hasn't yet reached the point. I mean, take, for example, the war, right, the war in 1948 that Israel had to fight right after it was declared, and five Arab armies plus Palestinian Arabs ganged up in order to try to destroy Israel. That, of course, is Milchemes Chovo, right? Okay. Now, what about the Six-Day War? It was started by Israel, as you remember. They were not attacked, but it was necessary in order to defend the.
Because they were gathering on the shore.
Nasser was threatening to throw them into the sea, absolutely. Yeah. Right. Right. In every way. So, that, how do you count it? Call it the Milchemes Rishus, or Milchemes Chovo, that's a fine line. Okay. Now, King David fought wars against other nations. But he was not, all right, let's say against the Philistines, we can understand it was necessary to regain Eretz Israel from the Philistines, who had subjugated. Okay, that would be in the category of Milchemes Chovo. But when he made a war, let's say, against Aram, didn't have to, but he felt he had to expand the territory of Israel. So that already is a Milchemes Rishus. Okay? Now, the Gemara is going to say later on that David could not do it on his own. He needed authorization. So who would authorize him? The answer is he would be authorized by a Sanhedrin. But what Sanhedrin? Not 23. You have to have the great Sanhedrin decide that. Because, you know, there was no Congress over there. So they were the closest thing, let's say, to a Congress that they had. So they needed that. I mean, just as today, supposedly America doesn't conduct a war unless it has congressional approval, you know. Sometimes it doesn't work.
It
doesn't work. Right. Another thing. V'ein mosifin alo ir v'ala zoris LLP. You do not expand the territory of Eretz Yisrael, of Yerushalayim. In order to do that, you have to have the consent of the Besdin of the Sanhedrin Gedola. Okay? The same thing would apply if you had to make the Beis HaMikdash larger, adding more room over there, or more courtyards for people to come in and so on. Because, you know, theoretically the boundaries of the Beis HaMikdash were fixed, but it was necessary to expand, so it still required the Sanhedrin Gedola in order to authorize making this part of the Beis HaMikdash. I don't have to tell you, I mean, because it now becomes holier in status than what it was before. So that had to be determined by the Sanhedrin Gedola. Okay. 71, right. Einosin Sanhedrios Lishvotim Lapim Besen Shelshim Miechot. Okay. Torah tells us, Shoftim, Shotrim, Titen Lecho Becho Shurecha, right? You want to set up judges and constables in all your gates. What do you mean, all gates? It means in every town, every city. So, okay? So, you have to set up a Besen. Okay. But who determines who should be members of the Besen? The answer is, it's the Sanhedrin Gedola. They have to authorize it. So they have to, do, you know, check it and so on, because, you know, just as theoretically the Supreme Court is also the court that has to look over, you know, courts that are lower than it, you know. So the same thing over here is true. The Sanhedrin Gedola, that they have to look over the courts that were set up in the various cities and towns. Okay, and then it's written, Ein osin ir hanidachas elapi bezden shel shivim echad. Torah speaks about a city where they all become idol worshippers, right? They all become idol worshippers. Then in that particular case, that city is supposed to be destroyed. But, again, how can you condemn a whole city to it? So the answer is, only the Sanhedrin Gedola has the right in order to do that. And it also says, Ein osin yehadidachas, Ein osin yehadidachas was four. You do not make an yehadidachas, even if they did that, if it's right near the boundary of Eretz Yisrael, because if you destroy a city right near the boundary, then what's going to happen? You have weakened the defenses of Eretz Yisrael and makes it easier for those to come in. I don't want to say that Sderot, for example, is in Yer HaNedachas, God forbid, it's not. But nevertheless, look at what has happened over there. I mean, what's happening with Israel? It's the whole Mr. Gus. They should have a long time ago done something in order to defend Sderot against the people in Gaza who are shooting all the time, and then, but because Condoleezza Rice tells Olmert, no, so Olmert tells the army, he says, don't you dare go and fight over there. It's a gefährliche thing. If he had read this, or he had studied this and believed in it, he wouldn't take a city, a town on the border and weaken it so that it can be overrun by the enemy any time that they want to.
I read in the letter that I sent that he could have a weapon called a sling of David. I think it's called Iron Rel or something like that. I think they have to stop all this coming in. It'll take like 3 years to get
them. Yeah, who knows? I don't know.
This reasoning,
yeah.
When they were... they didn't want Syria, they kept the Golan Heights.
Right,
to
right.
To protect that border.
Absolutely.
That
absolutely.
That,
yeah, so we'd love to get it back. But I remember when I was in Eretz Israel back in 1965, the first time that I was there, the Syrians were on top over there, top of the Golan,
yeah, right.
Overlooking Lake Kinneret and Tiberi and so on. And every once in a while they'd be shooting.
When I was there in 72, for a very short time, they allowed us to go up there.
Yeah.
We went to that very outlook place where they built a menorah out of the pipes, ammunition
right,
pipes.
Right, right, yeah.
And that was the place that they had taken over.
Yeah.
Because previously, they even showed us where the Syrian bunkers were.
Sure.
In the hills below.
Right.
All the Syrian bunkers.
Right, right.
Then they closed it up. They didn't allow
You had the heights over there, and you know, they overlooked Israel down below over there,
so that's why,
and they could keep on shooting over there. So that's why the Golan is very necessary to defend Israel.
Right.
No question. And of course, Israel has built it up since you know, since the Six-Day War that took it over. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Yes, Velosh Shalosh. Likewise, you don't make, you don't destroy three cities, calling them, you know, Ir Hanidachas. Avolos Hanidachas Oshtayim. But you can declare one or two cities in the interior, as the Rashi would say, that they could be Ir Hanidachas. Of course, I have to tell you, concerning some of these things, there's a Gemara that says, there's a certain guy, you like to say, says that, for example, Bain Sarah and Mora, Lohoyev Lo Nivra, the rebellious son, you know, the Torah talks about, the one who has to be brought and put to death and so on, he says.
It never
existed. Yeah. Okay. And he says likewise, here had the dachas, lower you know that also that is something that never existed. But because the Torah mentions it, so therefore you know, it should not happen to Chas v'Shalom. But they feel that it has to be discussed, okay. All right, now, you asked the question before, how do they get the number? Okay, so they say, Sanhedrin Gedola, the great Sanhedrin, Hoyeso Shel Shivim V'Yechon, right? Consisted of 71 judges. Uketano, and the lesser one, you know, the one that dealt with the capital cases, right? So that Shel Esom B'Shlosha. That needed 23. So they say, Menayan Ligadola, how do we know from the Torah itself that the you know, the higher Sanhedrin, Shehisha should be Echad, that it should consist of 71? Shenamar, as the Pasuk says, all right, the Rebbeinu Shalom says to Moshe Rabbeinu, he says, Espo li Shivim Ish Mizikle Yisrael, right? Gather unto me 70 people among the elders of Israel. Moshe al Gabehin. And Moshe was together with them. So if you have 70 elders together with Moshe, so now you have 71. But Rabbi Yehuda Omer, he says, Shivim. He says, no, Moshe is included in the 70, so there are only 7. All right. In this case, we don't follow Rabbi Yehuda, we follow the Chachon. Okay. Menayin Liktana, now that we know that the lesser Sanhedrin, Shehi Shalesim Bishlosha, that we need 23 judges. Shenamar, as it's put, as the Torah says, Vishoftu ho Eda, Vitsilo ho Eda. The assembly has to judge, and the assembly has to save. Now, see, who does he have to save? If a person committed murder accidentally, okay? So if you remember, they set up cities of refuge, okay? But you can't go to the city of refuge unless, or you can't live in the city of refuge unless you have a bezdin to authorize it. Okay, so the shoftu ha'edo, right? You have an edo shofetus, as it says over here in the Gemara. In other words, they judge him, you know, negatively, right? They judge him. Let's say that he is guilty. The hitzilo edo, and there's an edo that saves him. In other words, there is an edo that's out to save him from going over there to rescue him. Okay? And how much is a neder? That's what they want to know, right? Harekan esri, right? If you add the two eders together, how many we have? We have 20. Uminayan the eder shehi asorah. How we know that eder means 10 people? Shenemar, as the pasuk tells us. And of course, if you remember, this is in connection with the spies who went to Eretz Yisrael. 12 went originally, okay? But the Rebbeinu Shalalem complains to Moshe Rabbeinu about 10. He says, Ad Bosai lo Edo Horo O Hazos, right? How long can I have to put up with this evil congregation, okay? Yotsu Yahushua the Kolev. In other words, who were the exceptions? Yoshua and Kolev, right? So, out of the 12, 10 would be the Eder, okay?
If we get a minion?
That's a minion, right? That's the basis for a minion. Because a minion is also an Eder, okay? Umenayan, Lohavi, Ochlosho. Now that we know that you have to add to the 20 another 3. So he says, Mimash Bashanemar, this is derived from our interpretation of a Pasuk. Pasuk says, Lo Siyeh Achare Rabim Liro'os. Do not follow a multitude in order to commit evil. In other words, don't follow a multitude in order to condemn somebody. Okay? That's how they interpret it over here. Shomeyani, so from this I understand that I can be with this group, right, with the majority. In other words, I can be a member of a majority in order to free a person, okay, Latova, for good. So, in other words, I need only a majority of one in order to free someone, right? But for evil, I need more than a majority. This is the reasoning going on over here, okay? So he says, all right, M. Cain, so if that's the case, it says, you know, I can be with them for good. So why then does the pasuk say, do not follow the multitude in order to do, to make a decision for bad? He says, that how you decide for good is not the same as how you decide for evil. When you decide for good, it's al pi echad, that all that you need is a majority of one. But to decide, you know, to condemn somebody, you need al pishnaim. You need a majority of two.